Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly, and I wish you a very happy new year. Here's to 2026. I have a must list. Actually, it's a best of 2025 must list, which is kind of interesting because it is a 2026 article and a mix of things. Plus, the Golden Globes are next weekend, so I have a couple articles about those. Let's start with the must list. Caleb Cohen's perfect single, The Next Thing is Forever, and Borderline continue our hidden gems of 2025 must list. 007, Road to a Million, and Disco Witches of Fire Island round out our staff list of recommendations. This is by Tiffany Kelly. We just said so long to 2025, but before we fully embrace 2026, we're offering up five more hidden gems from the past year to end your holiday break with. That said, if you're already eager to populate your streaming queues, don't forget to check out our 2026 preview issue with exclusive looks at the big TV shows and movies set to debut in the coming months. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. First on our list, Caleb Cohen's East Coast Summers. Folk rock singer Caleb Cohen has the perfect bonfire song, whether you're on the East Coast, West Coast, or no coast. Shout out to whoever programmed my gym's playlist with this unconventional pump-up pick, allowing me to catch easy, sunny season vibes via this indie earworm, even as we enter deep into sweater weather. Forever. For her Netflix series adaptation of Judy Blume's classic young adult novel, Mara Brock Akil from Girlfriends updated the 1975 story, transforming it into a magnificent and modern tale of a bumpy romance between two Los Angeles teens, played by Michael Cooper Jr. and Lovie Simone, in 2018. Disco Witches of Fire Island by Blair Fell. What are disco witches? Disco-obsessed witches, obviously, and one coven has used its magic for years to protect the gays of Fire Island. This fun romance-y by Blair Fell glistens with queer magic even against the bleak background of the 1980s HIV and AIDS crisis. Borderline. Ray Nicholson and Samara Weaving are a winning combination in Cocaine Bear writer Jimmy Warden's directorial debut, which is available on Peacock, about a pop star and her obsessive fan. Nicholson portrays a delusional stalker whom viewers will warm to, while Weaving skewers celebrity culture. And we have 007 Road to a Million. This beautifully shot Prime Video reality competition upped the dramatic tension in season two, which saw pairs of loved ones complete challenges at iconic James Bond filming locations. Bonus points for Brian Cox's return as host and other Bond alum cameos. That was Caleb Cohen's perfect single, Forever, and Borderline continue our hidden gems of 2025 must list, and it was by Tiffany Kelly. Here are the biggest snubs and surprises of 2026 Golden Globes nominations, from a recent Emmy winner to one that was just plain wicked. This is by Jared Hall and Joyce Eng. The international journalists who make up the Golden Globes got a lot right with their 2026 nominations, but as is usually the case, there were some names we expected to see on the list that weren't, as well as some surprising ones to make the cut. Here are our picks for the biggest snubs and the most surprising of surprises. In the snubs category, we have Wicked for Good. Sure, stars Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande are both nominated for their performances as Elphaba and Galinda, and it scored two original song nominations for Stephen Schwartz. But the biggest and best musical of the year didn't make it into the Best Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy category? Granted, none of the nominees, Blue Moon, Begonia, Marty Supreme, No Other Choice, Nouvelle Vague, One Battle After Another, are musicals, but come on! Yes, reception to the second Wicked film, like the stage production, hasn't been as grand as the first, but Nouvelle Vague? Okay. A cinematic and box office achievement nomination doesn't make up for this, Globe voters. Quinta Brunson from Abbott Elementary. Much like teachers who don't get their due, Quinta Brunson was overlooked in the best performance by an actress in a television series, musical or comedy, for the first time in the sitcom's run. She won the category in 2023, handing Jean Smart from Hacks one of her rare defeats at any awards show. That night saw Abbott Elementary take home trophies for series and Tyler James Williams. Abbott only made the series cut this year. Brunson is still nominated as an executive producer, but her acting snub signals that the aging comedy, currently in its fifth season, is on the downswing with awards bodies. Brunson's omission comes 3 days after she was also snubbed by the Critics' Choice Awards. While the show and co-stars Chris Perfetti and Janelle James scored nods. Will the Emmys follow suit, especially if there are only 5 slots again? Catherine Lanassa from The Pitt. The Pitt won 3 acting awards for Noah Wyle, Catherine Lanassa, and Sean Hitosi, en route to claiming outstanding drama series at the Emmys, but the Globes only handed an acting bid to Wyle. The Globes don't have a guest category, so Hitosi, who won the Emmy in Guest, was sadly never going to be a factor here in the catch-all best performance by a supporting actor in a television series category. Lanassa, however, was expected to make the supporting actress lineup, but she missed out to 3 ladies from The White Lotus, all of whom she beat at the Emmys. Reigning Emmy champs from other genres, comedy winner Hannah Einbinder from Hacks, and limited series winner Erin Doherty from Adolescence, and former Globe winner Catherine O'Hara from The Studio. A possible factor for her exclusion? The Globe's voting body consists of international journalists, and The Pitt is not yet widely available around the world. Season 2 is premiering stateside in a month, but the UK hasn't even gotten season 1, and won't until HBO Max launches there in March. The Ladies of Marty Supreme. The supporting actress category has been a bit of a head-scratcher for a few months now, what with 2 potential nominees from Sentimental Value, that's Elle Fanning and Inga Ibsdotter Lias, 2 from One Battle After Another, that's Teyana Taylor and Regina Hall, Wicked's Grande, Weapons, Secret Weapon, Amy Madigan coming for a spot, as well as Sinners, Wunmi Mutsaku, and actors fave Emily Blunt from The Smashing Machine, all considered strong contenders. Alas, Timothy Chalamet's Marty Supreme co-stars Gwyneth Paltrow and Odessa Azian, who play his movie star mistress and knocked-up girlfriend, end up not making the final bracket in this crowded field. Even their director, Josh Safdie, was shut out of the directing category, though he and Ronald Bronstein did get Best Screenplay nomination. Surprises is our next category. Ava Victor from Sorry Baby. Most awards pundits thought the 6th slot in the Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture Drama category would go to Sydney Sweeney for Christie, or perhaps Laura Dern for Is This Thing On? Lucy Liu's performance in Rosemead is even building chatter. But Ava Victor's name is perhaps the last name many expected to be called, maybe even for Victor herself. She gives a beautifully subdued, curious, layered, tragic, but also humorous performance here, one that's not easy to forget. Hearing her name brought a smile to my face. Well done, Globes, and Victor. Jacob Elordi, The Narrow Road to the Deep South. Jacob Elordi's supporting actor nomination for Frankenstein was not surprising. His best performance by an actor in a limited series or motion picture made for television bid for The Narrow Road to the North, though? Very much so. You're probably thinking, Jacob Elordi had a TV show this year? That he did! Based on the novel of the same name, the 5-episode limited series, in which Elordi plays a Far East prisoner of war, quietly dropped on Prime Video on April 18th, 4 days after the streamer, which already had international rights, acquired U.S. rights. The Emmys didn't touch the low-profile show at all, but it makes sense the Globes would, not just because its voters are international journalists, but also because said journalists primarily cover film and are not as caught up on TV. How else do you explain Jeremy Allen White three-peating for The Bear earlier this year and now being a 2-time nominee for the show and Springsteen Deliver Me From Nowhere? They were already nominating Elordi for Frankenstein, so of course his name would pop up for them in a TV category. Similarly, Amanda Seyfried was a shoo-in for the film side for The Testament of Anne Lee, and also bagged a TV nomination for her low-key Peacock limited series that was also passed over by the Emmys, Long Bright River. No Other Choice is next. What is No Other Choice, you ask? If you haven't heard of the South Korean black comedy, that's because it hasn't hit theaters yet. The newest movie from director Park Chan-wook from Old Boy and Decision to Leave, which scored 3 Globes noms, opens in limited release this Christmas Day, and if it's playing near you, go see it as a gift to yourself. Like so many South Korean films, it's a wild take on the class system and what happens when desperate times call for desperate measures. Don't be surprised if you hear this movie mentioned at other awards shows. That was the biggest snubs and surprises of 2026 Golden Globes nominations, and it was by Jared Hall and Joyce Ng. Also, for Golden Globes, this article is kind of older, but it suits it. Nikki Glaser returning to host 2026 Golden Globes as first back-to-back host in 11 years. This is by Joey Nolfi, and I wanted to just give you the heads up of who's hosting next week. Following a well-received debut as MC of the 2025 ceremony, comedian Nikki Glaser will return to host the 2026 Golden Globes, where she'll become the Globes' first back-to-back broadcast host in 11 years. CBS revealed Glaser's upcoming return 2 months after Glaser made Golden Globes history, becoming the first woman to host the event solo. The last time the Globes welcomed the prior year's hosts was in 2015, with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler finished a 3-year streak at the event. Glaser initially took the reins from fellow stand-up comedian Joe Coy, who performed a widely criticized opening monologue at the top of the 2024 show. Glaser, however, received critical praise for her on-air duties. Among jokes that landed in the room and with audiences at home throughout the ceremony were quips about the show's waitstaff being the hardest-working actors in showbiz, as well as a Conclave and Wicked musical mashup titled Popular, that also saw her wearing a papal hat. In an interview with Entertainment Weekly ahead of her Globes debut, Glaser explained her approach to the gig. "I have to say who I am first. I have to be a little softer and more self-deprecating," she revealed of her strategy, "because I'm not as well known. I can't just come out swinging. They'll be like, who is this lady and why does she think she has a right to talk this way? I can't come in with the same annihilating venom as I did at the Tom Brady roast. With status comes the ability to punch harder." In a press statement about her 2026 return, Glazer said that hosting the ceremony was without a doubt the most fun I have ever had in my career, adding, I can't wait to do it again, and this time in front of the team from the White Lotus who will finally recognize my talent and cast me in season 4 as a Scandinavian Pilates instructor with a shadowy past. Golden Globes president Helen Hayne also noted Nikki Glazer brought a refreshing spark and fearless wit to the Golden Globe stage this year. Her sharp humor and bold presence set a tone for an unforgettable night, making the ceremony feel vibrant and, most of all, fun. That's Nikki Glazer returning to host 2026 Golden Globes as first back-to-back host in 11 years, and it was by Joey Nolfi. The other Golden Globes older article I have is another setup so that way you're ready for next week. Golden Globes announced bizarre new Best Podcast category for its film and TV awards show. This is also by Joey Nolfi. The Golden Globes announced a strange new development amid the group's evolving identity on the awards circuit with the implementation of a new Best Podcast competitive category. Beginning with the January's 2026 Golden Globes ceremony, the organization will recognize the best podcasts of the year among its awards slate, citing extraordinary and diverse talents in podcasting and seismic growth in the podcasting space as justification for adding the category to its film and TV-centric show. As the world of entertainment continues to evolve, we are excited to recognize new forms of storytelling, said the Globe's president, Helen Hayne, in a press statement. She added that podcasts have emerged as a profound medium for sharing narratives and building communities across global borders and generations, and that the inclusion of a new category expands the Golden Globes' ability to recognize new narrative outlets. Hayne finished her statement by stressing that by celebrating achievements in both audio and visual podcasts, we aim to honor our heritage categories while making room for new voices and formats to be heard. The Golden Globes announcement elaborated further on the new competitive categories nomination process, which will involve highlighting the top 25 podcasts that qualify for the award, with 6 advancing to the final nomination slots for the category. The Golden Globes have long established a reputation for favoring starry A-lister projects on the awards trail, and the podcasting space now boasts a wealth of celebrity projects hosted by famous stars, with everyone from Michelle Obama to Kelly Ripa, Bowen Yang, and Dax Shepard fronting popular shows on their platforms. The Golden Globes' new category follows a trend for major awards bodies that have announced new competitive brackets, including the Oscars, which recently revealed it would implement new categories for stunts and casting at future ceremonies. The 2026 Golden Globes air Sunday, January 11th. That was Golden Globes announced bizarre new Best Podcast category for its film and TV awards show, and it was by Joey Nolfi. From their Saturday Night Live section, Michael Che reveals the most tense moment he's witnessed at Saturday Night Live. Scary, almost. This is by Jillian Sitterholm. In Michael Che's 11 years on the Saturday Night Live cast, including a stint as head writer, there is one moment that stands out as the most high-pressure day on the job. The Eddie Murphy Show was the most tense start to a show I've ever been a part of, Che reveals in Netflix's Being Eddie documentary. It was, like, scary almost, like this had to go well, and we would be letting down Eddie Murphy if it was bad. The episode marked the Coming to America's first time back hosting the show in 35 years. Murphy skyrocketed to fame as a member of the Saturday Night Live cast from 1980 to 1984 and is credited with carrying the comedy show on his back and out of an era of rocky ratings. But in 1995, he cut ties with the show for decades after David Spade made a joke at his expense. Murphy finally returned to the Studio 8H stage to front the December 21st, 2019 show, and the stakes could not have been higher, nor the excitement more palpable. The Weekend Update co-anchor shares in the documentary that Saturday Night Live boss Lorne Michaels wanted Murphy to do something that was a bit more personal for his opening monologue, because people just wanted to hear him talk, she says. But the nutty professor seemed a bit apprehensive. I think he was a little, not worried, but cautious of doing a monologue, she remembers, saying that was when Michaels had the idea to invite back former cast members Chris Rock and Tracy Morgan and frequent host Dave Chappelle, all of whom had been heavily inspired by Murphy in their own careers, to share the stage with him for the opening. Current star Kenan Thompson later joined them on stage in a significant moment in the show's history. Seeing Eddie Murphy in Studio 8H, it's like, I can't explain, Chappelle says in Being Eddie. It's like being on safari and seeing a lion in the wild. Behind-the-scenes footage from a rehearsal of the monologue moment shown in the documentary captures Chappelle saying, "This is one of the most exciting things I think I've ever done, honestly." To which Morgan replies, "Yeah, I agree." She says he further witnessed just how excited the comics were to be a part of their idol's return. There was a moment in the rehearsal, my dressing room had Chappelle and Chris Rock, and they were calling their moms to tell them that they were doing the Eddie Murphy show, she recalls. In my dressing room, I'm watching them kind of geek out. After the live episode was in the books, Rock told Michaels to hang up his hat in victory. It was one of the greatest SNLs ever, Rock says in the film. And I walked over to Lorne Michaels when it was over and I said, "You should quit right now. It's not going to get any better than this." Although Murphy hasn't returned to host Saturday Night Live since, he did participate in multiple sketches during the show's 50th anniversary special earlier this year. "Going back to Saturday Night Live was a great experience," Murphy says. "My creative energy, everything had been turned back up to 10. Being Eddie is streaming on Netflix now, while Saturday Night Live is expected to return with new episodes in January, following a winter hiatus. That was Michael Chi reveals the most tense moment he's witnessed at Saturday Night Live, scary almost. And it was by Jillian Setterholm. Bridgerton is back, and here, this is exclusive to Entertainment Weekly, and from their 2026 preview, Bridgerton showrunner teases high stakes and juicy conflict in Benedict and Sophie's season 4 romance. The upcoming season, which drops its first part on January 29th, will see Benedict's life change after meeting a mysterious lady in silver at his mother's ball. This is by Emlyn Travis. Bridgerton is putting a unique spin on a traditional fairy tale romance in season 4. Shonda Land's hit Regency-era drama makes its grand return to Netflix next year, that's this year, with its first part arriving January 29th, followed by a second installment on February 26th. As custom, the season will follow a brand new member of the Bridgerton family on their quest to find love, this time chronicling the charming and equally complex relationship between artsy daydreamer Benedict Bridgerton, played by Luke Thompson, and pragmatic maid Sophie Bake, played by Yeren Ha. We start with a character trope that we've seen a million times before, which is a maid who falls for someone above her station, writer, producer, and showrunner Jess Brunnell tells Entertainment Weekly. But I think a lot of times in these classic Cinderella-like stories, Cinderella is a bit of a damsel in distress. And in the case of Sophie Bake, there is no such thing. We get to watch a very headstrong young woman try to decide her fate for herself and pick up the courage to believe in and dream for a life greater than the one she currently has. She notes that Julia Quinn's third Bridgerton novel, An Offer from a Gentleman, which tells Benedict and Sophie's love story, was the easiest book to adapt for the screen thus far. It lent itself really closely to the television structure for a love story, Brunell explains. There are just a lot of rich set pieces that give us juicy conflict and high stakes. I think fans will be happy to see quite a few of the set pieces from the book in the show. That includes matriarch Violet Bridgerton, played by Ruth Gemmell's sumptuous masquerade ball, where Benedict falls head over heels for a mysterious and dazzling partygoer known only to him as the Lady in Silver. Spoiler alert, that's Sophie. In a surprising turn of events for the Bohemian Bachelor, we've watched 3 seasons of Benedict having a very good time and being good at everything, but unable to commit to any one thing, Brunell says. And I think at the top of season 4, that's worn a little thin for him. I think he senses that something is missing in his life, even if he isn't ready to accept it. But once he meets the masked woman in the first episode, everything will change for him. While they may meet at the ball, Entertainment Weekly's exclusive imagery reveals the pair eventually flee the festivities to share a private dance together in a blossoming pergola. Brunell recalls being enchanted by the electric chemistry between Thompson and Ha when shooting the heart-fluttering sequence. For filming The Master, they ran it all the way through, and it was just like watching theater, she says. I remember sitting at Video Village watching them run it all the way through the first time, and we made the joke on set, just print that, because it was so perfect and so moving and so full of tension and sparkle and chemistry. It's really a special scene. But alas, no moment lasts forever, and Benedict will have to dive headfirst into the marriage mart if he hopes to reunite with the woman of his dreams. Thankfully, he can count on his family to aid him on his journey. It's a season where we try to make sure all the siblings feel present in some way and present in the main love story as much as possible, Brunell says. Eloise, played by Claudia Jesse, for example, has a very tight relationship with Benedict, and she will be involved in his search for the masked woman this year. Meanwhile, fresh from her enchanting evening with Benedict, Sophie returns to everyday life, serving the formidable Aramita Gunn, played by Katie Leung, and her 2 debutante daughters, Rosamund, played by Michelle Mao, and Posey, played by Isabella Wei. While Araminta and Rosamund are known to be quite villainous characters in the novel, Brunell shares that this season will dig deeper into the reasons behind their more nefarious decisions. On our show, we try not to ever present anyone's character in black or white. We're interested in the gray area. We're interested in why people do the things they do, she says. So we've spent some time trying to understand Araminta, where she comes from emotionally, and getting to do that exploration was really interesting for us as writers, especially since her daughters are also looking to marry this season. Seeing the way Araminta guides her girls versus the way Violet guides her girls, or Lady Featherington guided her girls, the compare and contrast is quite illuminating, Brunell adds. The class disparity between Sophie and Benedict also brings a totally new sensibility to Bridgerton, allowing Brunell and the writers to fully pull back the curtain on the upstairs-downstairs dynamic between the socialites and their staff. We talked a lot about going downstairs and how that would affect the overall tone of the show, and I think, actually, it seamlessly blends into the themes that we were trying to explore this season, she says. Benedict very much lives in a fantasy world. Sophie very much lives in a harsher reality. The idea is that, for each of them, neither of those stations are where they need to live in order to find true love. It was also important to Brunel that they didn't glamorize the lives of the servants running these high society households, but rather highlighted that there are still beautiful moments and beautiful friendships downstairs, the same way there's beauty upstairs. As a result, viewers can expect to meet some new faces working with Sophie across the season, too. And yet, when it comes to relationships, Sophie and Benedict's love story is only the tip of the iceberg this season. Penelope, played by Nicola Coughlan, and Colin, played by Luke Newton, will also get a chance to showcase what their marriage looks like after tying the knot last season, as will Francesca, played by Hannah Dodd, and John Sterling, played by Victor Alley. Penelope is also coming to terms with the reality of unmasking herself as Lady Whistledown, and how it puts her directly in Queen Charlotte, played by Golda Rochevel Seitz. It's high stakes. On the one hand, the Queen loves to be entertained, Brunel says, but on the other hand, the Queen does not like to have anything written that she disagrees with. So Penelope is in a tricky position this year, trying to please the Queen without giving up her journalistic integrity. That means having to write about her new extended family, too. The Bridgertons are gossip fodder, she adds, so she's going to have to do a bit of it. Elsewhere, Violet and Lord Marcus Anderson's, played by Daniel Francis's, flirtationship is continuing to pick up steam. In season 3, they did a lot of giggling and light flirting and lots of blushing, Brunel says, and it feels like in season 4 we pick up from that. But we're in a season in which we're exploring courage in so many ways. We're also exploring whether Violet is ready to be brave enough to put her heart on the line. Benedict and Sophie are on a similar journey. Benedict needs to be braver about committing and going after what he really wants and believes in. Sophie needs to be courageous in love and courageous about allowing herself to dream, she says. And you can apply that to so many things outside of romantic love. I think all of us could channel a little more courage to be our true selves and go after what we really want in our everyday life. The first installment of Bridgerton promenades its way onto Netflix on January 29th, with part 2 arriving February 26th. That was exclusive to Entertainment Weekly. Bridgerton showrunner teases high stakes and juicy conflict in Benedict and Sophie's season 4 romance. And that was by Emlyn Travis. Here's where I'm going to take a quick moment to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. Now we have Matt Damon, Anne Hathaway, Tom Holland are a family divided in the new Odyssey. And this is exclusive to Entertainment Weekly. This is by Jared Hall. Christopher Nolan isn't one for telling small stories, and this next one is no exception. In fact, it's an epic. The Oppenheimer Oscar winner is tackling one of the most expansive stories ever written, Homer's The Odyssey, a work of Greek literature written around the 8th century BC. He's reteaming with Matt Damon, who stars as Odysseus, king of Ithaca, on his 10-year trek home following the Trojan War. That journey isn't an easy one. Along the way, he encounters mythical creatures, including the Cyclops Polyphemus, as well as the seduced to death by song sirens, and the witch Circe, who famously turned Odysseus's men into pigs. The movie is also a reunion for Nolan and Anne Hathaway, who played Selina Kyle and Catwoman in 2012's The Dark Knight Rises, and Dr. Brand in Interstellar. Here she plays Odysseus's wife, Penelope, who's been holding off potential suitors, all of whom want her hand and crown in marriage. Tom Holland plays their son, Telemachus, who in Homer's original literature eventually leaves Ithaca to seek information about his father's whereabouts and fate. In addition to Damon, Hathaway, Holland, and Patel, the Odyssey also stars Robert Pattinson as well as Zendaya, Lupita Nyong'o, Elliot Page, Charlize Theron, John Bernthal, Benny Safdie, John Leguizamo, Bill Irwin, Samantha Morton, Jesse Garcia, and Will Young Lee. Universal Pictures has described the movie as a mythic action epic shot across the world using brand new IMAX film technology. Audiences who saw select movies this summer and fall in IMAX, including Jurassic World Rebirth, Superman, The Fantastic Four First Steps, and One Battle After Another, got a sneak peek at footage from the movie, which included flashes of Odysseus, Telemachus, and a shadowy figure played by Bernthal, perhaps Agamemnon's brother, Menelaus? Who's heard telling Telemachus, "I know nothing of Odysseus, not since Troy"? Telemachus pleads, "I have to find out what happened to my father. When did you last see him?" In addition to directing, Nolan also wrote the script. Surely no easy task, considering Homer's Odyssey was comprised of 24 books, and is producing with his wife, Emma Thomas. The Odyssey hit theaters July 17, 2026. That's Matt Damon, Anne Hathaway, Tom Holland are a family divided in new The Odyssey. And that was by Jared Hall. Neil Diamond had a surprising reaction watching Song Sung Blue, the true story of a Neil Diamond tribute band. Director Craig Brewer shares what the legendary singer-songwriter asked after seeing the movie, which stars Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson. This is by Jared Hall. Neil Diamond, you could say, is a believer in Song Sung Blue. The new movie, written and directed by Craig Brewer and starring Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson, isn't a biopic about the legendary singer-songwriter, but he and his music play a big role in the true story of Mike and Claire Sardina. The two Wisconsinites meet later in life, fall in love, and form the Neil Diamond tribute band Lightning and Thunder to big success, propelled by Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder, who, as seen in the movie, asked them to open for the band on a stop in Madison, though in real life they joined the band's encore at Milwaukee's Summerfest in 1995. So when filmmaker Greg Coase got a cease and desist letter from Diamond's record label just before his 2008 documentary about the Sardinas, also titled Song Sung Blue, debuted at a film festival saying he couldn't show the movie with the music, it was Vedder who called up Neil Diamond and sent him the documentary and said, "You gotta watch this and you gotta let them use the music," Brewer tells Entertainment Weekly. Neil Diamond saw the movie, he was so touched by it, and he intervened and told his publishing company to leave Greg alone and show the movie. But was Diamond as touched by Brewer's movie? "I was not in the room with him, but I had a few spies," Brewer says, adding that Diamond's family, including his wife Katie, as well as his team, were there. "I had also been prepped that Neil does not get effusively enthusiastic or into movies. He watches them, he studies them, that's what I was told." Brewer prepared himself for a neutral response, perhaps something a bit ambiguous. "But I was told from his people that they were surprised to see just how enthusiastic he started to get with it, that he was tapping his foot, that he would applaud after each music number, and that he cried," Brewer recalls. "He went up to the projectionist, or the person running the screening, and when they introduced themselves to him, he said, 'Okay, well, when's the next screening? Can we watch it again?' And so I was so happy about his reaction because I hope what it does for him, not that he looks for this or needs it, but I just hope he knows how incredibly relevant his contribution to songwriting is. Those songs are beautiful. And yeah, he's a performer, but he's a writer. He wrote these. He thought about them. He felt them in his soul and he created them." That's what you could call some beautiful noise. Song Sung Blue is in theaters now. That was Neil Diamond had a surprising reaction watching Song Sung Blue, the true story of a Neil Diamond tribute band. And it was by Jared Hall. I don't know if I'm falling into the drama, but it seems like because we just did Song Sung Blue and it's out now that I should read this. Son of Song Sung Blue musician calls Kate Hudson and Hugh Jackman monsters and slams film as all lies. The biopic drama, which is directed by Craig Brewer, tells the story of real-life musical couple Claire Thunder and the late Mike Lightning Sardina. This is by Lauren Huff. Song Sung Blue may have razzle-dazzled audiences and critics, but one person is not a fan of the new biopic film, the son of one of its subjects. The drama, which stars Kate Hudson and Hugh Jackman and is directed by Craig Brewer, tells the story of real-life musical couple Claire, who plays Thunder, and the late Mike, who's Lightning, Sardina, who performed together in a Neil Diamond tribute band known as Lightning and Thunder. My father's rolling in his grave right now, Mike's son, Michael Jr., 41, told the Daily Mail in an interview, adding that the films completely destroyed the one thing my father worked his entire life to pass on, his legacy. I want the true story out there, and I want it used with truth, with dignity, and I want retribution. Everybody thinks it's such a wonderful film. It's so touching. It's all lies, claimed Michael Jr., and it steals all the hard work that my father put in his entire life. Mike died at age 55 in 2006. His son, who does not appear in the film as a character, claims he was purposefully cut out of the film, but was paid to serve as a consultant, as was his sister Angelina, who's played in the film by King Princess. Angelina also voiced her thoughts to the outlet, saying, "The only thing that was true is the love story between my dad and Claire. It's a beautiful story, but that's not how it went down, and I guess that's what's upsetting because it's a lie." Michael Jr. also took issue with the film's stars and their promotion of the movie, claiming to the outlet, "Every interview that those monsters have been on national television don't even mention my existence at all, even though I was the most prevalent force in my father's life, even when I wasn't in Wisconsin because I'm his only son. They didn't even try to contact me. They didn't try to get more information. They could have very easily asked Craig Brewer." Both Michael Jr. and Angelina were invited to and attended the film's premiere in New York City on December 11th, as did Claire, 64, and her two daughters, per People. According to the report, Claire has been a prominent fixture in promoting the project. In addition to the New York City premiere, she attended the Milwaukee premiere of the film on December 2nd with her daughter Rachel, and even joined Jackman and Brewer on stage to introduce the film. She also sang Sweet Caroline with Jackman the following day at Landmark Lanes in Milwaukee. Reps for Jackman, Hudson, and Focus Features did not immediately respond to Entertainment Weekly's request for comment. That was Son of Song Sung Blue musician calls Kate Hudson and Hugh Jackman monsters, slams film as all lies. And it was by Lauren Huff. Here's something else from Entertainment Weekly's 2026 preview and exclusive to Entertainment Weekly. Young Sherlock team reveals a new take on iconic sleuth, teases incredible Moriarty friendship. This is by Lauren Huff. There's a wall in London's Sherlock Holmes Museum that features the faces of all the actors who have tackled the iconic detective, which hero finds Tiffin came across while doing research for his own turn in Young Sherlock. Daunting is a good word. There is definitely a bit of that, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare star tells Entertainment Weekly before correcting himself. I mean, there still is a bit of that because it's not even out yet. Don't get him wrong. He says he's immensely proud of and can't wait for the world to see the series, which hails from director and executive producer Guy Ritchie. It's just that the weight of such a beloved character is not lost on him. He is, after all, a fan himself. I've always been a fan of Sherlock, from my dad saying, "No S, Sherlock," every time I said something obvious, all through Guy's film installments, he says, referring to the Robert Downey Jr. starring Sherlock movies, which Ritchie also directed. I've been obsessed with the character and Guy's work. I feel like I'm peaking way too early because this is what dreams are made of for me. One person who wasn't daunted was showrunner Matthew Parkhill, also a longtime fan of the IP, who said he lived by one major rule when crafting the series. "I had a rule to myself, which was, I'll never touch anything that is in the canon, right?" he says, meaning, "I'll never touch anything that starts after that first Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story. I felt that anything that happened before that, for me, it felt like a blank page. So I tried not to be too daunted, but I was respectful." To that end, young Sherlock is best described as an explosive, action-packed reimagining of the sleuth's early days. It starts with a raw and unfiltered young Sherlock, who is a bit disgraced after landing himself in jail for stealing wallets. Not for the money, mind you, but out of sheer curiosity if he could pull it off. When his brother Mycroft, played by Max Irons, lands him a lowly job at Oxford, Sherlock finds himself embroiled in a murder mystery which unravels into a globe-trotting conspiracy. With Ritchie's signature style and wit, the series essentially begs the question, why is Sherlock the way he is? It attempts to answer that by taking a deep dive not only into his first mysteries, but also by picking apart his family dynamics. In an ironic twist of fate, we wouldn't call it a coincidence because the universe is rarely so lazy, as Sherlock would say, Fiennes Tiffin's real-life uncle, Joseph Fiennes, plays his on-screen father, Silas. Fiennes Tiffin says he's always wanted to work with the various members of his Hollywood family, which also includes his cinematographer father, writer-director mother, and actor uncles Ralph and Joseph, but he always was conscious of the importance of that coming about in quite a natural way, which may or may not be the case with young Sherlock. I don't know if I believe Matthew when he says this, but when they were looking to cast the role of Silas Holmes, I think they went out to Joe, and Matthew said shortly after, "Oh yeah, that's Hero's uncle, I forgot," Fiennes Tiffin recalls, "and I call bull-ass on that, sorry, but nevertheless, it did feel really organic. And when he said, 'Would you mind that? How would you feel about that?' I said, 'I would love nothing more.'" Watching the two ultimately work together was so sweet for Parkhill, who fondly recalls his first meeting with Fiennes, where he told countless memories about his nephew. Apparently, Fiennes used to do magic tricks for Fiennes Tiffins when he was little, a story which Parkhill loved so much he wrote it into the show. "It was so interesting to watch them work together," Parkhill says of their dynamic. "Sherlock is incredibly smart, incredibly capable, incredibly verbose. He can talk the legs off a donkey, but when he's around his dad, somehow it strips him back to being 13 again every day. There's something of that with Sherlock and his dad, and there is also something of that watching Hero and Joe. It was funny." Both Parkhill and Fiennes Tiffin also took great enjoyment in a different dynamic in the show between James Moriarty, played by Donal Finn, and Sherlock. Unlike in other versions of the characters, here the two develop a great friendship after meeting at Oxford, at least for now. I always imagined what it would be like. How did they end up such mortal enemies? And I always thought, what if he had this incredible friendship, Parkhill says. During development, he and Ritchie were strongly influenced by the dynamic between Paul Newman and Robert Redford's titular characters in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and used that as a comp for their Moriarty and Sherlock relationship. You kind of get two origin stories for the price of one, Park Hill teases. Moriarty gets in hot water as well. And I think if these two hadn't met, it's sort of like a pinball and a pinball machine if they hadn't met. Sherlock wouldn't have become the Sherlock that we know, and Moriarty wouldn't have become Moriarty. Fiennes Tiffin admits that given how later in life Moriarty and Sherlock seem to know each other better than they know themselves, it makes perfect sense that they would have started out as friends. Nevertheless, he jokes that he secretly struggled with the twist a bit. I was kind of like, because I love the characters in the stories, I'm like, can we just hurry up and not be friends already? He says with a laugh. And I have to remember, this is what makes our show so fun, is that people know where they're going to go, but we're not going to get there yet. And it's all about teasing the audience with and giving them just enough to be fed, but stay hungry when it comes to Sherlock and Moriarty's relationship or Sherlock's skills as a detective or in fighting. And I think that's going to be really fun for people to watch. Park Hill promises the series should be just as fun for longtime fans and those who don't know Sherlock from a bucket of paint. But for the former, there are plenty of Easter eggs, from the appearance of young Inspector Lestrade to the origin of Sherlock's classic deerstalker cap to the beginnings of some of his classic sayings and more. As for a possible appearance of Sherlock's classic sidekick Dr. Watson, well, Park Hill says, never say never. But I still have that golden rule to myself, which is I can't rewrite anything that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote. That said, Park Hill feels he and Ritchie had the legendary author's posthumous blessing to make their version of the detective completely unique to anything that came before, and yes, that includes Ritchie's films. He cited the well-known tale of actor and playwright William Gillette, who wrote to Doyle about the liberties he could take with the character, to which Doyle famously replied, "You may marry him, murder him, or do what you like with him." I interpret that as a kind of, I took that as his blessing, Park Hill says. So I think it's a show that Sherlock fans will love. I just tried to have fun with it, and I tried to be respectful, and I hope we've done him justice. I think we've done him justice. In addition to Fiennes Tiffin, Irons, Fiennes, and Finn, young Sherlock also features Natashka McElhone as the sleuth's mother, Cordelia, Sain Singh as the enigmatic Chinese princess Gulan Shoen, and Colin Firth as Oxford's Sir Bucephalus Hodge. The Young Sherlock game is afoot, starting in March on Prime Video. That was Young Sherlock Team reveals a new take on iconic sleuth, teases incredible Moriarty friendship, and it was exclusive to Entertainment Weekly. It was by Lauren Huff. For our last story, we have why Paul Mescal doesn't want you to see him for the next 2 years. This is by Mikishana Pierre. Paul Mescal is forever grateful for his prosperous movie career so far, but he's ready for a break from the big screen and all the promotional work that comes with it. In a new interview with The Guardian, the Gladiator II star revealed that he plans to take some time off after a run of starring in major films every year since his breakout role as Connell on Hulu's TV adaptation of Sally Rooney's Normal People in 2020. Once I've finished promoting Hamnet, I hope nobody gets to see me until 2028 when I'm doing The Beatles. People will get a break from me, and I'll get a break from them, Mescal told the outlet during his interview alongside History of Sound co-star Josh O'Connor, noting that he'll ration some upcoming projects. But Mescal clarified that to him, rationing doesn't necessarily mean less. It means learning that films like The History of Sound take more out of the well, he explained. You can't keep going back and expect to consistently deliver something you're proud of. What that rationing looks like, I don't know. I miss being on stage, so I might have a time when I'm only doing theater for a couple of years. I also have different priorities in my personal life that I want to attend to. Mescal has been undeniably in demand. In 2022, he starred in God's Creatures, Carmen, and Aftersun, the latter of which earned him his first Oscar nomination. In 2023, he broke hearts alongside Andrew Scott in All of Us Strangers and appeared with Saoirse Ronan in Foe before he starred in 2024's highly anticipated Gladiator II. In 2025, he played English playwright William Shakespeare in Hamnet from Academy Award-winning Nomadland director Chloe Zhao, and based on Maggie O'Farrell's 2020 novel of the same name, starred on stage in the latest revival of Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire at the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Harvey Theater, and featured opposite O'Connor in The History of Sound, a queer romance set in 1917 America from director Oliver Hermanis. I'm 5 or 6 years into this now, and I feel very lucky, but I'm also learning that I don't think I can go on doing as much, Mescal shared. While the actor conceded that the concept of rationing roles goes against the imperative to stay visible and current, he reasoned that it's wiser than the alternative. I don't want to resent the thing I love. This sounds bold, but I'd rather not be on the train if that is the choice, he asserted. The great hope is to slip away from the spotlight until his next major role, which will be starring as Paul McCartney in Sam Mendes's 4-part biopic about the Beatles. And if the actor really wants, he can keep a low profile until Richard Linklater's movie adaptation of the George Firth Stephen Sondheim musical Merrily We Roll Along, which opens in about 2 decades. That was why Paul Mescal doesn't want you to see him for the next 2 years, and it was by Mikishana Pierre. And that's all the time I have for Entertainment Weekly this week, the first of the new year. Thank you all for listening this year and for listening last year. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please come back next week and we will dive into maybe what they're predicting for Golden Globes. There's usually an article about that. And I still have some 2026 preview articles to read. Those are some long ones. So maybe we'll get to one of those. Until then, goodbye.